We are together again, climbing in the planes of our existence. Chapter 19 in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge and the Synthesis of Yoga. We'll pick it up where we left off. All this means that the natural relations of Purusha to Prakriti in the material universe are the complete absorption of conscious being in the force of its workings. Therefore, the complete self-oblivion and self-ignorance of the Purusha, the complete domination of Prakriti, and subjection of the soul to nature. The soul does not know itself. It only knows, if anything, the workings of Prakriti. So this is when the soul consciousness, Purusha, invests itself completely in the nature which above, in the realms of originating being, are one and the same reality, where Sat is coexistent with Chit, and Chit, aware of itself, of its own being, is full of delight. Sat Chit Ananda is where the two poles are one entity. But here, descending into involution, accomplishing the material fact of a universe, appear as if they are poles. Spirit is there, matter is here. And if the soul identifies with the form-making material energy, then it permits itself to be engrossed. And ignoring its real nature, suffering the fruit of that ignorance, is identified with its material encasement. The emergence of the individual self-conscious soul in man does not of itself abrogate these primary relations of ignorance and subjection. For this soul is living on a material plane of existence, a poise of Prakriti in which matter is still the chief determinant of its relations to nature. And its consciousness, being limited by matter, cannot be an entirely self-possessing consciousness. Even the universal soul, if limited by the material formula, could not be an entire possession of itself. Much less can the individual soul, to which the rest of existence becomes, by bodily, vital, and mental limitation and separation, something external to it, on which it is yet dependent for its life and its delight and its knowledge. These limitations of his power, knowledge, life, delight of existence are the whole cause of man's dissatisfaction with himself and the universe, because he misses what he was. He has lost that and must recover it, and that's the whole purpose of the universe's involvement in this play and of the individual's involvement in the universal play. And, he continues, if the material universe were all, and the material plane, the only plane of his being, then man, the individual Purusha, could never arrive at perfection and self-fulfillment, or indeed to any other life than that of the animals. There must be either worlds in which he is liberated from these incomplete and unsatisfactory relations of Purusha with Prakriti, or planes of his own being, by ascending to which he can transcend them, or at the very least, planes, worlds, and higher beings from which he can receive or be helped to knowledge, powers, joys, a growth of his being otherwise impossible. So these steps, the padam, as the Veda calls it, as certain Upanishads also style it, the steps of being, planes, which are bases, which are the foundations upon which we stand. But there isn't simply one plane of being. There's a staircase, as we alluded to, as in Savitri, Book 2, the world chain is described, going one level up at a time until one gets back to the mystery of the Divine Mother, from which all comes. These all describe different relationships that the soul power has with nature, universally and individually. And if we agree to live on any of these planes, then we become a citizen of that plane. That basis becomes our basis. But here, we're evolving creatures. So not only do we have a material basis, but we have embedded within us the worlds, the planes of prana, the worlds, the planes of mind, and all the stuff that belongs to the higher regions. All of that is somewhere in our being. And the whole point of evolution is to discover and unmask and bring those powers, those felicities to the front. And as we go, those higher portions of our self, of the world, in a sense, want to call out to us, want to deliver to us the delights of their world, or to suborn us to their will as they wish to express it in the world. So he'll go through a long description now of how these various things can have placement in our physical consciousness, in our physical lives. So let's read those last phrases again. Planes of his own being, by ascending to which he can transcend them, or at the very least, planes, worlds, and higher beings, from which he can receive or be helped to knowledge, powers, joys, a growth of his being otherwise impossible. So being, consciousness, and the bliss of the exploration of nature, all of these are deeply significant, even in a world that seems to be ignorant. All these things, the ancient knowledge asserts, exist. Other worlds, higher planes, the possibility of communication, of ascension, of growth by contact with and influence from that which is above him in the present scale of his realized being. So these inner highways from above lead to our physicality and are constantly in commerce with us. We are speaking to them. We are seeking their solace. We are seeking their intercession. They are sending energies to us. So there is this colossal exchange of energies throughout nature. But because we're encased, engrossed simply in the material form, we don't perceive it. We barely feel it. We hardly intuit it. But it's there. And it's real. as there is a poise of the relations of Purusha with Prakriti, in which matter is the first determinant, a world of material existence, so there is another just above it in which matter is not supreme, but rather life force takes its place as the first determinant. So the preceding paragraphs were all about the description of the material world. Annamaya Purusha, the Purusha as engaged in the world of food, the plane of food. Now we come to Pranamaya Purusha, the Purusha poised in the power of life, who we shall see directly governs matter. In this world, forms do not determine the conditions of the life, but it is life which determines the form. And therefore, forms are there, much more free, fluid, largely, and to our conceptions, strangely variable than in the material world. This life force is not inconscient material force, not even except in its lowest movements and elemental subconscient energy, but a conscious force of being, a movement of chit, which makes for formation, but much more essentially for enjoyment, possession, satisfaction of its own dynamic impulse. Desire and the satisfaction of impulse are therefore the first law of this world of sheer vital existence, this poise of relations between the soul and its nature, in which the life power plays with so much greater a freedom and capacity than in our physical living. It may be called the desire world, for that is its principal characteristic. So the material is fixed in form, and the vital is fixed in power, seeking its own satisfaction. Here's the source of the push for gratification. Moreover, it is not fixed in one hardly variable formula, as physical life seems to be, but is capable of many variations of its poise, admits many subplanes ranging from those which touch material existence and, as it were, melt into that, to those which touch at the height of the life power, the planes of pure mental and psychic existence, and melt into them. So, if we're thinking of these as rigid demarcations, where mind is not influenced by life, and soul is absence the interference of the vital world? No, there is a great commerce among them all. Remember, existence is one, the omnipresent being, the omnipresent reality. Things are not so chopped up as that. For in nature, in the infinite scale of being, there are no wide gulfs, no abrupt chasms to be overleaped, but a melting of one thing into another, a subtle continuity. Out of that, her power of distinctive experience creates the orderings, the definite ranges, the distinct gradations by which the soul variously knows and possesses its possibilities of world existence. Again, enjoyment of one kind or another being the whole object of desire, that must be the trend of the desire world. But since wherever the soul is not free, and it cannot be free when subject to desire, there must be the negative as well as the positive of all its experience. This world contains not only the possibility of large or intense or continuous enjoyments, almost inconceivable to the limited physical mind, but also the possibility of equally enormous sufferings. It is here, therefore, that there are situated the lowest heavens and all the hells, with the tradition and imagination of which the human mind has lured and terrified itself since the earliest ages. All human imaginations indeed correspond to some reality or real possibility, though they may in themselves be a quite inaccurate representation or couched in two physical images, therefore inapt to express the truth of supraphysical realities. To which you can be referred to the letters on yoga. Nature being a complex unity and not a collection of unrelated phenomena, there can be no unbridgeable gulf between the material existence and this vital or desire world. On the contrary, they may be said, in a sense, to exist in each other and are at least interdependent to a certain extent. In fact, the material world is really a sort of projection from the vital, a thing which it has thrown out and separated from itself in order to embody and fulfill some of its desires under conditions other than its own, which are yet the logical result of its own most material longings. So there is substance in vitality, and it wants to codify that, it wants to densify that. So as he will show us, each grade, each plane of being proceeds from another, which, expressing its own native force, brilliance, power, whatever it might be, thrusts down and creates a plane below it in which it can play, in which it can achieve something that was not possible, some rich experience that was elusive to it in its own plane. And so, from vijnana we get mind, from mind we get the world of life, from life we get the material encasement, and matter falling asleep dulls itself down into the inconscient. But, happily, all rises, because all seeks unity, because all wants to reunite. Love is at the core of the cosmos, and we come soaring, well, maybe we're not quite soaring yet, but we come with an insistent urge to come out of that material encasement and rise sinuously through these various planes of being until we can become awake of what these powers are, and then finally awake of the soul who is supposed to be regent, at least, sovereign over them all, aware, awake to the divine nature. And now we begin to convert the contradictions of existence into a long play in which the song of delight is heard. We begin dully. We proceed vigorously. We sing sorrowfully sometimes, but there is a song beyond sorrow. And it is yet to be sung. Let's start this paragraph over. Nature being a complex unity and not a collection of unrelated phenomena, there can be no unbridgeable gulf between the material existence and this vital or desire world. On the contrary, they may be said in a sense to exist in each other and are at least interdependent to a certain extent. In fact, the material world is really a sort of projection from the vital, a thing which it has thrown out and separated from itself in order to embody and fulfill some of its desires under conditions other than its own, under which are yet the logical result of its own most material longings. Fulfill some of its desires under conditions other than its own. It pushes forth, it wants an adventure. It's bored. It wants to go into a search of all the mysteries of existence. And so we arrive at darkness. Is it a mistake? Is anything a mistake? Can it be possible that there be a mistake? All of this arising from the conscious being of one reality, it isn't an accident. So could it be a mistake? Might it not instead be intentional? And who gets darkened by this process but its own being? Can it afford it? It is so poor that it can't afford a moment of darkness. Is it so weak that it can't rejoin its mighty source above? Oh, stop. Our own manifest vital being is also only a surface result of a larger and profounder vital being, which has its proper seat on the life plane and through which we are connected with the life world. Moreover, the life world is constantly acting upon us, and behind everything in material existence, there stand appropriate powers of the life world. Even the most crude and elemental have behind them elemental life powers, elemental beings by which or by whom they are supported. Sri Aurobindo describes in The Life Divine how anything that moves in the physical world is really propelled by this secret, unseen, pranic power. It is here. Life is what moves things. The influences of the life world are always pouring out on the material existence and producing there their powers and results, which return again upon the life world to modify it. So in a sense, as we evolve their powers here, they discover there in the pranic plane something new, something about our experience emboldens, enlightens, enriches them. Were it not so, why would they be so eager to offer their gifts, to experience, even to dive down into matter themselves and take up the burden and say, come, I'll help you lift this. From that, the life part of us, the desire part, is being always touched and influenced. There too are beneficent and malefic powers of good desire and evil desire which concern themselves with us even when we are ignorant of and unconcerned with them. Pardon me. Nor are these powers merely tendencies, inconscient forces, nor, except on the verges of matter, subconscient, but conscious powers, beings, living influences. As we awaken to the higher planes of our existence, we become aware of them as friends or enemies, powers which seek to possess or which we can master, overcome, pass beyond, and leave behind. It is this possible relation of the human being with its powers of the life world which occupied to so large an extent European occultism, especially in the Middle Ages, as well as certain forms of Eastern magic and spiritualism. Well, let us hasten to say, much of the tantric tradition, whether you call it Hindu or Buddhist, refers to such things. And then, more recently, Swedenborg, Theosophy, Anthroposophy, all of these things are deep inquiries into the nature of these forces. Occult, simply because they are hidden to our view, not occult because they are necessarily devious. Whatever is the intent of the spirit that wants to wield the power, it can be maleficent, it can be beneficent. Don't blame the power. It is this possible relation of the human being with the powers of the life world. Oh, I read that. The superstitions of the past. Much superstition there was, that is to say, much ignorant and distorted belief, false explanations, and obscure and clumsy dealing with the laws of the beyond, had yet behind them truths which a future science, delivered from its sole preoccupation with the material world, may rediscover. For the supra-material, beyond the material, is as much a reality as the existence of mental beings in the material universe. Let's not forget Sufism. Let's not forget the Kabbalistic tradition. Let's bring them all along to this larger mystical party, shall we? But then, ha! But why then are we not normally aware of so much that is behind us and always pressing upon us? For the same reason that we are not aware of the inner life of our neighbor, although it exists as much as our own and is constantly exercising an occult influence upon us, for a greater part of our thoughts and feelings come into us from outside, from our fellow men, both from individuals and from the collective mind of humanity. And for the same reason that we are not aware of the greater part of our own being, which is subconscient or subliminal to our waking mind and is always influencing and, in an occult manner, determining our surface existence. There's a great deal here. So remember Sri Aurobindo's experience in Baroda when he sat with Lele on the rooftop and he was said, look at your consciousness. Look at your mind. Watch. You'll see thoughts trying to come into you from outside. And he looked. He'd never thought of that before. But as he looked, he saw, indeed, that they do come swimming in. And at Lele's suggestion and behest, he stopped them, one after the other, one after the other. And in a moment, he's very kind about it. He says, it took me 3 days. But in one swooping moment, he was liberated from identity with all that he had been. And he realized, what is that behind? Huh. 3 days to make the mind permanently silent. But the insight was instantaneous. Then he could decide how to filter this swimming ocean of thought. What does he want to permit into the keys? Quays. What does he want to keep out? So too, inwardly, so that may be from outside us in the circumconscient realm, but we have within us dimensions of our being that we have to become aware of as well. Some of it is subconscient, where our half-digested experiences get thrown and they sit there in this large warehouse. They're not completely dead, and they will stir and suddenly manifest and send some vibration into us. We know not where it comes from. And then we have to respond to it and deal with it. And it alters our mood, our day, our direction, maybe even our future, because we haven't dealt with it sufficiently. And then there is that which is subliminal, which is simply behind the line of our consciousness. Here he could be referring to all of those secret worlds of mind, life, and matter, which are unknown to most people, but which we can yogically discover if we will apply ourselves to the investigation. So all of that, from around and from within us, is constantly in conversation with our being. It is because we use normally only our corporeal senses. Here he gets to the reason why. What's the reason for this? It is because we use normally only our corporeal senses and live almost wholly in the body and the physical vitality and the physical mind. And it is not directly through these that the life world enters into relations with us. They don't have to come knock at the external gate because it's a picket fence. It's simply a mesh, and there's no real division. There's a suggestion of a difference, but there's no real territory. You don't have to bring your passport there. That is done through other sheaths of our being. So they are termed in the Upanishads. Other bodies, as they are called in a later terminology, the mental sheath or subtle body in which our true mental being lives, and the life sheath or vital body, which is more closely connected with the physical or food sheath, and forms with it the gross body of our complex existence. So here he's talking about bottom-up, anamaya kosha, pranamaya kosha, manomaya kosha, and ultimately, vijnanamaya kosha. You can substitute the term sharira if you want. Kosha means sheath, sharira means body. So the panchakosha, the five bodies, appears in the earliest of the Upanishads, in the Brihadaranyaka, at 112. You'll find it there, described not as these five, which we've just spoken about, leading up ultimately to Ananda, but described as Anna, right, food, matter, prana, the life force, power, manas, the brilliant mind, bach, the divine word from which all comes into manifestation. So, equivalent to vijnana in the other system, and avyakrita, what is beyond making, what is unmade, what is original, and that's the original consciousness. So in the Brihadaranyaka, all flows from this undescribed, unmade being. In the Taittiriya Upanishad, all flows from Ananda. Doesn't say that there's nothing above Ananda, just puts it at the pinnacle of the cosmology that it presents. Back to our words here. These possess powers, senses, capacities, which are always secretly acting in us, are connected with and impinge upon our physical organs and the plexuses of our physical life and mentality. By self-development, we can become aware of them, possess our life in them, get through them into conscious relation with the life world and other worlds, and use them also for a more subtle experience and more intimate knowledge of the truths, facts, and happenings of even the material world itself. So if you want to understand what's going on here in this world, you have to back inwards and you have to rise up a level. And then from that supraphysical posture, from that asana, that seat above, you can see down into what is really driving the enginery of the material world. Absent that, you're guessing. You're trying to make sense of the patterns of physical existence. Good luck. By self-development, we can become aware of them, possess our life in them, get through them into conscious relation. Purusha, engaged with Prakriti, with the life world and other worlds, and use them also for a more subtle experience. So here, behind the veil, in the subliminal reaches of our being, not simply registering in the sensorium of our body, and more intimate knowledge of the truths, facts, and happenings of even the material world itself. We can, by this self-development, live more or less fully on planes of our existence other than the material which is now all in all to us. So you can see that really the conscious soul is meant to be stationed at each and all of these levels in one moment. But we ought to be able to shift our attention and take a soul poise in relation to any of these planes and possibilities of our nature as we choose. So if we want to engage with the mental worlds or the vital worlds or the inner physical world, sukshma sharira, the subtle body, we ought to be able to take that poise. We should be free and flexible and be master of this instrument, not simply subject to it, not suffer the ultimate disintegration that death wags in our face constantly. Nonsense. We're more than that. We're more than that. What has been said of the life world applies with the necessary differences to still higher planes of the cosmic existence. For beyond that is a mental plane, a world of mental existence in which neither life nor matter, but mind is the first determinant. Mind there is not determined by material conditions or by the life force, but itself determines and uses them for its own satisfaction. There, mind, that is to say, the psychical and the intellectual being. And remember, he's not using the term psychical in the sense that he will later when he's writing letters on yoga. He's not referring to that. He's referring to the inner powers of the life being here. The psychical and the intellectual being is free, in a certain sense, free at least to satisfy and fulfill itself in a way hardly conceivable to our body-bound and life-bound mentality. For the Purusha there is the pure mental being, and his relations with Prakriti are determined by that purer mentality. Nature there is mental rather than vital and physical. Both the life world and indirectly the material are a projection from that, the result of certain tendencies of the mental being, which have sought a field, conditions, an arrangement of harmonies proper to themselves. And the phenomena of mind in this world may be said to be a result of the pressure of that plane first on the life world and then on life in the material existence. By its modification in the life world, it creates in us the desire mind. In its own right, it awakes in us the purer powers of our psychical and intellectual existence. But our surface mentality is only a secondary result of a larger subliminal mentality whose proper seat is the mental plane. So its enginery works from inside out. This world of mental existence also is constantly acting upon us and our world, has its powers and its beings, is related to us through our mental body. There we find the psychical and mental heavens to which the Purusha can ascend when it drops this physical body and can there sojourn till the impulse to terrestrial existence again draws it downward. Back to the Upanishads, and as far as these stations going above, that's even in the Christian tradition again, Irenaeus, the father of the Orthodox. Here too, might also refer to you, Brihadaranyaka, chapter 3, section 7, verse 20, etc. Here too are many planes, the lowest converging upon and melting into the worlds below, the highest at the heights of the mind power into the worlds of a more spiritual existence. So here we go arcing up. And the rays reunify with the sun. These highest worlds are therefore supramental. They belong to the principle of supermind, the free, spiritual, or divine intelligence, footnote, called the vijnana, the great knowledge, or buddhi, the illumined will, a word which may lead to some misunderstanding, as it is also applied to the mental intelligence, which is only a lower derivation from the divine gnosis. This equalization here of vijnana and buddhi is difficult in a lot of ways, not only because we bring in the Sankhya philosophy, but vijnana in some schools of Vedanta has a certain meaning, and in all schools of Buddhism has a completely different context and application. So, let's go back and reread. Spiritual or divine intelligence or gnosis, and to the triple spiritual principle of Sat-Chit-Ananda. So the supramental is a gate by which we regain communion with the three in one, Sat-Chit-Ananda, who are a triune reality. From them, the lower worlds derive by a sort of fall of the Purusha into certain specific or narrow conditions of the play of the soul with its nature. So, Sat-Chit-Ananda, through the supramental, in a sense gives birth. This is, I don't like the idea of a fall. This is a Christian, a Judeo-Christian concept of a fall. To me, this is a swan dive. This is something the Hansa does. Watch me as I soar and fly down into the cosmos. Here I come. I will claim all these worlds because I am sovereign. Nothing you can do can darken my feathers. And here I am, immersed. Do you think I'm underwater? Oh, watch this. And the swan comes up and sits atop the water and then stands, one leg lifted, still immersed in the water, eyes gazing upward. And if he lifted the other leg, all would vanish. The whole manifestation would go because he keeps his foot planted in the very mud beneath the water. He is both at once. One leg lifted, transcendent, free. One leg embracing, seizing upon the earth, solidly enmeshed in it, like a great tree. Here is the truth of the spirit in all its dimensions. So, but Sri Aurobindo writes, from the lower worlds derive by a sort of fall of the Purusha into certain specific or narrow conditions of the play of the soul with its nature. So all of this is the play of the soul. The soul, the Purusha, accepting this determination, that diminution of its being all the way down, cascading all the way down till it reaches the material frame from which we begin this story. But these are also divided from us by no unbridgeable gulf. They affect us through what are called the knowledge sheath and the bliss sheath, through the causal or spiritual body, and less directly through the mental body, nor are there secret powers absent from the workings of the vital and material existence. Our conscious spiritual being and our intuitive mind awaken in us as a result of the pressure of these highest worlds on the mental being in life and body. Our conscious spiritual being, that is that seed from Chit Shakti, that is that aspect of Ananda descended to individualize what is massive beyond cognition above. here. Here's the secret of your soul. Here's the psyche. And the intuitive mind, that portion of the mind which becomes first fully illuminated, if only by a point from that transcendent radiance coming from the supramental, expressing Satchitananda. But this causal body is, causal body, karana sharira, is, as we may say, little developed in the majority of men, and to live in it or to ascend to the supramental planes, as distinguished from corresponding sub-planes in the mental being, or still more, to dwell consciously upon them, is the most difficult thing of all for the human being. He knows, because he is himself ascending to it, as he writes this in 1917. It can be done in the trance of samadhi. So this secret too belongs to him. But he sets it aside. He insists on evolving to it and on having it descend into him. It can be done in the trance of samadhi, but otherwise only by a new evolution of the capacities of the individual purusha, of which few are even willing to conceive. Yet is that the condition of the perfect self-consciousness, by which alone the purusha can possess the full conscious control of prakriti. For there, not even the mind determines, but the spirit freely uses the lower differentiating principles as minor terms of its existence, governed by the higher, and reaching by them their own perfect capacity. That alone would be the perfect evolution of the involved and development of the undeveloped, for which the purusha has sought in the material universe, as if in a wager with itself, the conditions of the greatest difficulty. The perfect self-consciousness by which alone and Sri Aurobindo in 1917 was pushing forward. Alone, because even those few who were around him could not stand at his level, could not pick up the yoke. Sri Aurobindo was still 3 years away from having she whom we call the mother rejoin him. When Purusha and Prakriti, or better still, Ishvara and Ishvari, that rejoin and claim the earth for the divine. That was to come. He was writing in 1917, very bravely, never complaining, just noting down for those who wanted to read what the conditions of this synthesis were. How is it that we make life divine? And he's charting the course. So we mention the mother. These next two Sundays, rather than proceed in the synthesis of yoga, we'll take up the sixth chapter of the mother. Probably say a few things prefatory to the reading of the sixth chapter next Sunday, and we'll start it, and then we'll surely finish the sixth chapter on the 21st, on Mother's birthday. Some of us will be together anyway. You're welcome to come and join us on Zoom that evening. We'll share her company. We'll all be seated in her radiance that day. And I might note, we'll send to everybody, obviously, the link to the ashram's website where you can download the book on the mother for free. They're gracious, aren't they? Gracious and generous. And if you go to our website, iksc.org, you can find somewhere on there a series of readings that we did in the Mother a few years ago, which go line by line through the whole book, all six chapters. So, I think we are done for the evening. I'll read from Savitri and continuing where we were last time. We're on page 66 in Book One, the Book of Beginnings, in Canto Four, The Secret Knowledge. The master of existence lurks in us and plays at hide and seek with his own force. In nature's instrument loiters secret God. The immanent lives in man as in his house. He has made the universe his pastime's field, a vast gymnasium of his works of might. All knowing, he accepts our darkened state. Divine, wears shapes of animal or man. Eternal, he assents to fate and time. Immortal, dallies with mortality. The all-conscious ventured into ignorance. The all-blissful bore to be insensible. Incarnate in a world of strife and pain, he puts on joy and sorrow like a robe and drinks experience like a strengthening wine. He whose transcendence rules the pregnant vasts, prescient now dwells in our subliminal depths, a luminous individual power alone. The absolute, the perfect, the alone, has called out of the silence his mute force, where she lay in the featureless and formless hush, guarding from time by her immobile sleep the ineffable puissance of his solitude. The absolute, the perfect, the alone, has entered with his silence into space. He has fashioned these countless persons of one self. He has built a million figures of his power. He lives in all who lived in his vast alone. Space is himself, and time is only he. The absolute, the perfect, the immune, one who is in us as our secret self, our mask of imperfection has assumed. He has made this tenement of flesh his own, his image in the human measure cast, that to his divine measure we might rise. Then in a figure of divinity, the Maker shall recast us and impose a plan of Godhead on the mortal's mold, lifting our finite minds to his infinite, touching the moment with eternity. This transfiguration is earth's due to heaven. A mutual debt binds man to the supreme. His nature we must put on as he put ours. We are sons of God, and must be even as he. Our human portion, we must grow divine. Our life is a paradox with God for key. Namaste, Jai Ma.